Good morning and welcome to The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. We are broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, 261 Moore Street. Brunch is being served as we speak. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with my partner in crime,
Patrick Martins.
Thanks, Patrick.
Can anyone hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right.
So you're cool. And we are sponsored today by the Hearst Ranch. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable, native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. So for more information, you can go to www.hearstranch.com and read up a little bit more about what the Hearsts are doing.
We really do appreciate Steve Hearst and Brian Kenny and all done for us.
The singing cowboy. He's my favorite. I love that guy.
Well, this is big. We have a major
New York City.
This isn't like all the major, rest of the times where we have
major
just like
American,
family.
North American chef. Yeah, right.
Just like your daughter.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah, in my dreams. No, we have a major North American chef here. I hate to use the word star chef, and I know that you probably really avoid that like the plague, but the fact is that you belong in the pantheon.
Yeah, you're an
and
institution.
And our guest, shall we say who it is?
Yeah.
Michael Anthony from the Gramercy Tavern.
Hey, guys.
Hey, welcome, Michael. Welcome. Thanks so much for coming on a Sunday.
Yeah. Thank you very much for having me out. I'm psyched to be here.
Yeah, because most chefs really don't want to come on a Sunday because they want it's like one of the rare days that they're home with the family.
Especially if they have a 14-month-old baby. Is that your first child?
No. I have three daughters. I have two older daughters, 12, 9, and now a little baby Adeline.
Wow.
But my problem on Sundays is I work.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So what are your hours? I mean, it'd be interesting to know. I mean, are they always set? Do they change season to season or what?
Well, you know, the restaurant is open 7 days a week, so that means we're on all the time. The good news is that that restaurant in particular has an incredible staff. And, you know, that's, I think, one of the things that has defined the restaurant for years and years is this, you know, kind of wealth and richness of people who work there. So it's cool from, you know, from a chef's perspective to have tons of people that are, you know, that could be working anywhere they want, that could mm-hmm. probably run just about any restaurant that they set their sights on. And in my case, my schedule is bound to being there and in the kitchen. And it's also something I learned along the way is I have to take time off, and that's not a lesson that came easily,
mm-hmm.
but if you're going to do your job well, you have to bring energy. You got to be there.
So now let me ask, I mean, we have so many questions and we have, you for a few segments, so we're going to jump around. But I mean, since you brought that up, what is the average tenure of an employee at Gramercy Tavern? Have you ever figured that out?
Well, you know, it varies, but it definitely, in the kitchen, I think that if you look around New York City, it's probably fair to say that the average line cook stays in a good kitchen from 12 to 18 months or so. And okay. And in our kitchen, I think, you know, we feel really proud that stay is much longer. So while it's not stagnant, people aren't, you know, camped out growing old there and protecting their jobs. They're there to learn. They're there to work hard and then, you know, to either move up in our organization or challenge themselves. So, you know, probably 2 to 3 years is the average day for a line cook at Gramercy Tavern, and in the front of the house might move a little bit faster because, again, we're dealing with a group of smart people that have, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of passions both in the restaurant and out. And so when people get a chance to do their thing outside, they, you know, it happens. So, but I've never, ever experienced working in a restaurant that shows so much house pride. And, you know, grew up working in Japan and in France, and you see this this stuff that is part of their industry, right? That, you know, these are professionals that are there forever, right? They're not moving from one project to the next. This is what they do, especially from the front of the house perspective. And I've never seen or felt as much pride from a group of people for their restaurant, their jobs, and especially for the, it sounds a little corny, but for the guests, mm-hmm. the people who eat in our restaurant, we pay attention to them.
It's very French in that way, or, you know, I'm sure European in general, where people are lifers. You know, you go to a famous old French restaurant and maybe the guy's been there for 40 years. Not to say that they're stagnant and stayed, but to say that it's okay to be in the restaurant industry and not, you don't always have to be an actor or actress, you know, willing to take
no,
the first
being
a
waiter
out.
is a reasonable career choice.
And it's okay as to opposed be to completely a focused, right? Yeah. Here's the thing, is like, it's okay to be connected. Not to mention that there's a cool thing that happens in that restaurant, in that, yeah, you know, we are in an amazing organization. We have a visionary as a leader. But there's this sense of... there's a sense of, it's not just a service industry. What is happening in that restaurant is that it, without getting up on a soapbox, is that it acts as an engaged part of the community. These are people that kind of play a role of an educator more than just, hey, you know, I'm here today bringing you some food and here it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In and out. Now, how many of the people who still work there were there before you? And was that a challenge to, you know, learn from them, but also create your own
claim?
Well,
let's clarify. You've been at Gramercy for 4 years, right? Or
yeah,
five?
Five years now. Almost five years.
So there must be
years.
A few people that have been there longer, right?
Yeah, but, you know, I think there's probably maybe 25% or so of the people still there that were working at the restaurant before I got there. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, to be clear, my job there was to first join a team and figure out what you know, made that organization work. And you know, it works on a level, you know, that is, I don't know, maybe beyond a lot of restaurants, in that it's one of the longest standing traditions in American cooking. And so, yeah, it was the easiest job and the hardest job to step into. Mm-hmm. It was really about figuring out what made that place special and then running with it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that culinary tradition then for a second, and then I'm going to roll you right back to the very beginning, because I have to tell you, Michael, as I said outside, you're one of those people that just makes me gnash my teeth and feel unbelievably inadequate, because somehow you went from like 0 to 120 miles per hour in about, what, I don't know, 2 minutes?
When were you born, 1974?
68.
Okay,
I feel a little bit better. You're only 12
Katie
years
Katie was only
than
70 when you were born.
Right. So, for people who are outside of New York, who haven't had the pleasure of dining at Gramercy, let's talk a little bit about the culinary tradition that you had to step into and make a sort of seamless transition into.
Well, so the restaurant was created in 1994, and it was Danny Meyer's second restaurant.
Union Square being the first?
Union Square Cafe was the first.
Okay.
And, you know, it was a different time, a different era, and Danny, you know, thinks about the business in a way that's completely different from most. And I think he was reluctant, and maybe he might even admit scared to take the success and the hard work that went into creating Union Square Cafe and try to do it again. And, you know, again, that was a time when the proliferation of restaurants wasn't necessarily happening at the same pace. I think along the way, he said an amazing thing also, that he didn't want to create a restaurant that he couldn't walk to.
Oh, really?
But Gramercy Tavern went on to allow Americans to look at food, American cooking, in a different way. It took the very best in excellence, you know, kind of looking towards European tradition as the very best in fine dining, and then marrying that with the approachability and the comfort zone represented by Union Square Cafe. So it stepped into this new territory of calling itself a tavern, which no one had ever done before. And above all, it was a place where people could meet and could talk and drink, and then at the same time experience some of the best cooking around.
And was it always the same format, big tavern in the front and then rest fine dining in the back?
It was ahead of its time in terms of creating that format, where there is the fine dining restaurant and a casual front room. We refer to the front room as the tavern, and the back room as, you know, Gramercy Tavern, the main dining room. There is also a private dining room, and I think that from that time in the early 90s on, there probably hasn't been a restaurant that has the physical space that did not create a private dining room, because it is a great way to experience the restaurant, another great way to bring people together for different kinds of functions, and a great revenue center for restaurants.
Absolutely. So talk to us a little bit about this philosophy. I mean, for instance, why was Danny worried? I mean, most people, you know, anyone would be worried about opening a second restaurant, but Danny seemed to have to shoulder a lot more of a load of service and a standard. So, I mean, what was, like, when you first, you know, applied for the job and met Danny for the first time, like, what is the, I don't know, school of thought there? I mean, like, what's different about that place than some of the others that you've worked? And we'll get into where you've worked in a bit.
Well, without using, I mean, here is the amazing part. You know, restaurants have charismatic leaders that have that lead with intuition and that rub off on people that work with them. And a lot of restaurants are able to replicate themselves because they're either very technically very great at what they do, or they have a devote following and people who learn tricks by following their leader. In his case, I think he saw from the very beginning that the essence was to be able to teach what he was good at,
and which is,
I think it's understanding people, mm-hmm, and
what they
hospitality.
Want.
He has coined the expression enlightened hospitality, which, you know, is the foundation of his business philosophy, but he and his partners have been able to translate that into not necessarily a formula, but a way of talking about how to teach this to managers. And this is, I think, probably, you know, looking at it from a contemporary point of view, this is what makes that organization special, is that its businesses are not cookie cutter operations, but they have a solid common denominator. And it's kind of a foundation based on respect and taking care of people. So taking care of people means, first of all, and Danny says it in his business philosophy, is that the number one tenet of our company is to take care of each other. And that is a bit counterintuitive. It flies in the face of the golden rule in the restaurant industry of the guest comes first. And in the case of Union Square Hospitality Group and Gramercy Tavern and all the restaurants and businesses that make up that company, by putting each other in a good place where we can respond creatively, where we look forward to coming to work, where there's a dynamic feeling, you allow people to do their jobs well. Mm-hmm. You allow them to feel appreciated. You find time to, you know, to congratulate people for a job well done. And then one of the challenging parts of it is holding them accountable. I mean, it's not a place where everyone just has a smile plastered on their face and so everything's okay. It's about working hard, continuing to identify how we get better, but also taking the time to say, you know what, that's a really good job.
Well, you know, from a concrete perspective, a concrete experience, I mean, I've been lucky enough to be part of a few staff meetings at Gramercy Tavern. And really, I mean, I don't remember any other restaurant that put so much energy and effort into educating the staff. And you have, you know, 50, 60 people in a room, and they're all engaged.
Yeah, well,
and there's
didn't
a
we
Q&A.
Go to Gramercy with Mike Newman?
Mark Newman, and done turkey things there before, yeah. And, you know, people are asking questions, and not always the people that you would think. I mean, sometimes it's the guy that washing the dishes or, you know, running the tables who's like, wait, I have a question. And, you know, it's interesting that you say this service thing, because a lot of new restaurants, I think, it's about them. But it's not service. It's like you're coming into their house and you have to play by their rules. And if you break a rule, you're in trouble. And you never really get that sense at Gramercy Tavern. You're always, or, you know, really any of Danny's restaurants, you really are always under the impression that it's about you. And there is a smile and there's energy. And I always love, they're always like at the beginning of those staff meetings, they're like, we have a few people coming in, you know, John, it's his ninth time. He's coming in with his family for his birthday. I'm like, God, this isn't what I would want, you know, if I was going to go out with my family. I would want the staff to all know that I was coming.
I wanted to bring up a quote that I read on one of the many pieces of media that I read about you last night. And so I think it was something like, it goes like this. If you look at cooking around the world, the advantage we have in the States is that we have a sense of urgency to our learning curve. We are not bogged down by hard and fast rules. And collectively as chefs, we're breaking rules, but in a smart way. So what do you mean exactly by that? When we consider fine dining, the manipulative and flavor combinations and a heroic focus on where the food comes from, I don't know, sort of like that seems to sort of express something about the philosophy of good American restaurants, and particularly the Union Square Hospitality Group. Where does that sense come from of like breaking the rules and the urgency of the learning curve because we don't have the traditions?
Well,
or people are trained to differently here?
In some way, you know, we're at this point in talking about American cooking, and this is, you know, I think we're all in it. When I say we're all in it, looking across this city, New York City, even across the country, there's a very exciting moment, right, where we're telling a real story about ingredients. We're telling a developing story about the kinds of techniques that we apply to it. And there's, I think there's an opportunity here to start to think about how we cook and what's unique about it. So, you know, we talk a lot about this. I mean, in the Northeast, when we talk about ingredients, I think for years and years, we've looked out West and said, sighingly, if only we could have, you know, a long growing season and a climate like in California, then we could tell a real story about fresh ingredients. And I've always found that a little misguided. I think I may have felt that way at a particular time in growing up cooking, but I really see that as the opportunity is that we're embracing what it's like to eat in a particular place. And cooking in the Northeast, it's not a disadvantage. It's our greatest advantage looking at the climate, this temperamental growing season, the fast changing plantings, the availability of ingredients that are unique to the Northeast.
Maple syrup.
So I was just there. Back, yeah. So telling this story, first of all, it's a real story. We're not just imitating traditions from Europe, from Asia. We're telling a story that is rooted, deeply rooted, right here in our own region. And then, you know, the whole aspect of breaking rules is that we've seen a lot of discipline from cooks, people getting into the business young. Or changing careers, but being very serious about it and investing in their careers by traveling, by studying, by reading, and through their work ethic. And this is a great thing. I think we all recognize that we have to keep pushing that forward. If we're really going to be cooking seriously, discipline is a big part of it. But we also have this advantage that, you know, maybe this is just innate to being American or living in New York, is that we get to think of food in a way that makes sense to us and to our guests and to other chefs. And you said that you quoted me as saying, if we break rules in a smart way, that I don't know if that's the best way to put it. I probably said that, but it's more like in a sensible way. Mm-hmm. If the goal is to make food taste distinct and delicious, and we achieve that, then, you know, and we start to see and listen and watch other chefs doing similar things, it starts to take on a unique character. And so eating in New York should be different than eating in another city in another region. Mm-hmm. And little by little, you know, I don't think that there's anyone that has to necessarily put a label or a coat on this, but, you know, you see some similarities. You see people influencing each other, and that is very cool. I think that's
exciting. Don't you think that what happens in New York, though, is kind of, or I guess in any of the great American cities, but what I see in terms of the New York culinary scene is this incredible fusion of cuisines where, you know, different strands for you, for instance, I mean, let's go back to your unbelievable bio where you started, you had no interest in cooking
as
a child.
Wait a second. Let's not, this wait is, we a have minute. 1 minute left for this segment.
Oh,
so.
All right. Well,
do you want to get into the whole past yet? Sorry.
I'm just going like to say that because you have a background of, no, Jack is cool. Because you have a background that involves being trained in both French kitchens and Japanese kitchens, and you said to me earlier that your Japanese training still continues to have a major influence on your cooking now. That's kind of, I mean, I think a lot of the chefs are bringing that kind of discipline in from other countries and then turning it into something that is, I guess, uniquely American, uniquely New York.
Yeah, but, you know,
I like what Alice Waters said. She said, some people get it and some people don't. And if you get it, you can break rules and do things.
That's
if
just
you
like don't in the art it, world, too.
I mean, it's really true. I mean, my mom always said it. She's like, there is a right and a wrong. When it comes to taste,
and if you
there's don't culture
learn,
and non-culture. Yeah. And it's not to say that, you know, anything that's not culture is bad, but, you know, some people get it. You know, I mean, I'll say just about, for instance, Carlo from Roberta's didn't come from a background, and yet, left to his own devices with the piece of meat, it came out really good, you know? And so there's the right way. And many people who have studied in a million places, they don't get it and they'll screw it up. So anyway, it's an interesting thing. But once you're in culture, you can...
Yeah, you start incorporating
rules.
It. Yes.
As long as it stays in that right zone of not being
bad. It's just like the
bad.
Art world. You have to get the training. You have to learn the basics, and then you can break the rules.
When it comes to food, it's got to taste great.
Yeah.
And then you have to, you know, that has to be a shared value. People around you, you
have
think
to
it's
agree.
Great, but people have to, we're bound to, to this dialogue, yeah.
Yeah, it ain't going to work.
Like, I'm the only one that likes this. So we will be right back with Mike Anthony
from Gramercy Tavern.
Following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to The Speakeasy every Wednesday at 3 p.m., where host Damon Bolte will discuss cocktails, spirits, wine, beer, tea, coffee, and all things in the liquid universe, with guests ranging from bartenders and brewers, alchemists and ambassadors, roasters and regulars, and every expert and enthusiast in between. Learn from some of the world's leading experts in mixology, bar history, distillation, and brewing about how we enjoy imbibing today. Again, that's every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Damn, Jack, did you write that? That was well written.
Oh, that was
those are Damon's words.
Those are Damon's words.
Yeah,
even
good.
Regulars. I love that he put regulars in there. Because regulars
good.
Become experts, you know?
Absolutely.
You do enough of something.
So this is the main course for those of you who are just tuning in. And we are in the studio with Mike Anthony from the Gramercy Tavern.
Executive chef.
Executive chef, absolutely. Now, Mike, I'm going to dig into your sordid past, man. Because really, this is just so infuriating. So, Mike.
You're pissed.
I know. No, it's just, I can't stand it because I'm so competitive. But Mike, you went to Japan to study. What were you studying?
I went there to work, actually.
You went to work.
I had a minor in Japanese when I did my undergrad work at IU, and I went to travel and to just check it out. So I was working over there.
So he's working there, and then you got a job in a kitchen.
Yeah, subsequently.
How did it happen that a Japanese cook hired an American non-cook?
We want this American in
here.
We want to get things right.
So it was a great story.
Because they were
cooking
hamburgers and french fries and figured you were the man for the job?
It was actually a French-Japanese restaurant. And so it wasn't a traditional Japanese place, which is really tough to get into.
Yeah.
I got lucky, and it was an interesting lesson that I learned along the way. A friend introduced me to this chef. The friend was a guy who wrote the food column for the Herald Tribune at the time and the English newspaper in Tokyo.
Right.
And the chef's name was Shizu Oshima, a woman who had great training, worked both in Japan and in France at a very famous restaurant in the 70s, came back to Japan and opened her own restaurant, which in Tokyo, that was, I guess she opened probably in the mid-80s, that was unheard of. So not only to have a head chef that was female, but also a business owner. And she was a very tenacious person. I spoke just enough Japanese to show that I wasn't going to be a nuisance.
Did you learn that?
Well, again, in school and then traveling. When I moved over there, I worked hard to, you know, to kind of build on some of the academic information that I had. And I don't know, things come easy. Like when you're out there trying to meet people, it's like being a kid again. You mimic and you, you hear, you listen. So languages sure. come easy enough to me. And so she agreed. And I think along the way, she decided that she was going to show me that working in a kitchen wasn't all that fancy a job. She was going to test me, and she really kind of beat it into me that, you know, the kitchen's a tough place to be, and it's not for just people who want to, you know, who want to show off and hang out for a little while. And she taught me to love the kitchen for all the right reasons, actually.
Sure.
And I worked there for about a year and a half, and it was a tough apprenticeship. She taught me things and said things to me that I repeat almost every day at work. And so it was a great start. It was a challenging start. It was a real slap in the face.
So where were you before that? I mean, this is really your first serious kitchen job?
Yeah. Or? So like
you
in high school,
you had never worked in a kitchen before.
In high school, I worked in a pizza shop. In college, okay. I worked in a restaurant.
In the kitchen or in the front of the house?
In the front of the house. Mm-hmm. And I never really thought that I would do that for a living.
Did you care about food as a child?
As a kid, I was the worst eater in the world.
Me too.
I was the pickiest eater on the planet. And, you know, so it was not a likely outcome for me to fall.
So you didn't learn at granny's knee. This is like the sort of the cliched story. I swear to God, every
when
time
I was 5 years old,
grandmother,
I smelled
blah,
my
blah,
grandma.
Blah,
yeah.
So now, what position did you hold in that kitchen? And can you give us a tidbit of like one of the things that you repeat, like some epiphany that you experienced through this?
Yeah,
first
I mean,
mentor?
In and of themselves, they, you know, they're not going to be like, these aha moments. But, right. you know, things like, you know, think about the job through before you start. Choose the right tool for the job. Pick the right pan. And things like, you know, it's Friday night. Get your butt down in the grease trap and scrub it with a hand brush because that's your job.
Right.
And
right.
so it was everything. And so I learned the basics of, you know, of good organization in the kitchen. I learned, you know, that you have to take care of a kitchen for it to continue to operate. And then along the way, she taught me some really, you know, good basics to being a good cook. So
do you still keep in touch?
Yeah. Yeah. I was there 2 years ago, and stopped in to see her. She has since retired and sold the restaurant. I think it made both her and me feel really proud of, you know, reconnecting. So
that's cool. Great. And then after you worked there, you went to France to sort of continue your training. And
yeah.
Where did you work there?
Well, so here's the story. This particular Japanese chef, opened some doors. And this is the thing is that like for as roughly as I was treated in her kitchen, she followed up with me all the way, you know, and came to Paris twice to make sure I wasn't screwing around, to introduce me to some
That's
chefs.
So Japanese, though, because when they mentor for
Were
real.
Were you guys going out? Not no, just kidding. That sounds like she's following me to Paris.
No, but I'm surprised she didn't make you live in
no,
her
I
house.
No, I'm not glossing over the fact that this was not a romantic relationship.
That,
in
that
fact, it was
to me
more
also.
Like she came all the way to Paris, I think, to kick my ass again. But she introduced me to some influential chefs. And so when I showed up, I was there to go to school. And I signed up to go to a vocational school in Paris, which is the way most kids get into the restaurant industry in France. This is like kids between 15 and 18 that are getting, high school equivalency. And most of them spend 2 weeks working in restaurants and then 1 week back in the classroom. So when I showed up, I got into school and she came over initially and introduced me to a chef named Jean de Laveine, who was a famous chef through the 70s, had a 3 Michelin star restaurant in a town called Bougival called Le Camélia. And it was a restaurant where Joël Robuchon had done his apprenticeship. Mm-hmm. And this was a man who was, I saw where the brutality came from, and he was a very tough person. It was late in his career, and he was essentially the chef of a smaller restaurant. But when I showed up in Paris, I was going to school, and I would leave school and go and spend 3 nights a week in that kitchen, peeling things and trying not to, you know, to get hit.
Yeah.
And
But is that what they would do? They would really like throw stuff at you, and
it was an old school kitchen. It was rough.
I saw kids get cuffed when I worked.
Where does that culture come from? I mean, is it just that the chef was
it's archaic? It's just, you know, this is a combination of, you know, the way to learn a trade was, you know, by pounding it into people. A lot of the people in the old days, right, in Europe, like, these were not people that came into it with open ideas. They were learning a craft, and that's all that they had. And then I also think that there's a fair amount of abuse that comes into, somehow our industry accepted this.
Yeah, that's so funny.
But, you know, that's a way of the past, really. And although it's been sensationalized, and even some kids that come out of cooking school these days are looking for war stories. You know, if you're really running a kitchen seriously, you don't have time for that stuff. And it's not, you know, it's just not productive. It's
did
not
it,
a way to...
Did it help people? I mean, it must have, but at the same time, like beating... I mean, I've heard these horror stories. It's just so funny that
well, you know,
a place
you,
that produces
listen,
good
when you're
food.
Scared as hell, you react pretty fast.
Yeah. But also, I mean, you're dealing with kids. I mean, I worked in a kitchen in Paris for about 6 months, and the kids, I was much less knowledgeable. I was in my 20s, and the kids were like 15, 16, 17, exactly what you describe. And the chef would occasionally cuff one of them, you know, across the side of the head or something like that if he was horsing around. There was no talking in the kitchen, for starters. No goofing around, no giggling. It was very small. So, I mean, it's in a certain sense, there's a parallel with the Japanese model, which is the sense of the mentor, the chef, being the guy who's in charge of teaching you. And when you mess around, he's going to discipline you like a parent.
Well, there, you know, here's the takeaway for me is that there's nothing wrong with treating cooking seriously. And right. as long as we redefine what serious means, I mean, we take fun, we take having fun seriously, but not to be corny about it, but I think everybody has their style, right? How do you get people to focus? Mm-hmm. And this is all about finding ways to motivate people. And that is one very, you know, archaic and brutal way of doing it. There are lots of other ways, and playing to, you know, playing to people's strengths and making them love what they do, or at least understand what you know, what you love about what you do is, for me, a much more motivating factor than, you know, scaring them.
Well, enough about that. Enough about beating chefs in the kitchen. So where did you, how long were you there at that restaurant?
Well, so it was a 1.5 year program, and I spent about a year in that kitchen. And I also had a chance to, I was scraping. I mean, it was really tough to put together the, you know, the dollars to do this. And I was paying back loans from my undergraduate degree. And
the chefs pay you there? I mean, does a French restaurant pay you, or is it considered an internship when you work at a restaurant?
I was not paid in that job. So it was a privilege to get to just to show up and peel potatoes. But, you know, so I had a chance to go to school and finish school, and through school, the great part about this school was that it's, it was guided by the Chamber of Commerce of Paris, and along the way I met people that, you know, that built small bridges for me and opened doors. And so I was able to do a couple of externships, and then from those externships I started to build a network of cooks around the city. And I found, a couple of full-time jobs. And
you came back to New York from France, and you worked at Danielle March. Well, and Blue Hill, and then Gramercy Tavern. I mean, this is the thing that blows my mind.
So you came straight French. I mean, you were in the French frame of mind, so it made sense to you to come
go right to Danielle. Yeah.
Well, plus the chef I was working for, you know, picked up the phone and made a connection. And so when I moved to New York, I had a kitchen to, you know, to go right. to. And
you must have really impressed these Frenchies, man.
You must have peeled those potatoes really well. Just kidding. I know you did other things.
He probably eviscerated game birds and skinned animals. I didn't notice that they called up Danielle after I did that, though.
So you came straight, and then you worked at Danielle?
Yeah, I was intimidated. You know, I had never been to New York City before. And so
where are
I
you
said,
from? We didn't
I grew
even
up in Cincinnati, and partly in Cincinnati and partly in Syracuse.
Interesting city, Cincinnati. Anyway, we'll talk about that another time.
So I was intimidated moving to the city, and I didn't know many people, and I was lucky to have a job, and I showed up, and I felt like it was an exciting place to be. And this was in 1995, and it was not just an excellent restaurant, and, you know, Danielle has gone on to, conquer the world. Absolutely. But there was an interesting group of people working in that kitchen at that time, and as there still is today. But like at that particular moment, the 2 year period that I was there, I think that everybody that worked in that kitchen has gone on to either own their own business or run their own kitchen now. And that group stays, you know, in contact. It was really great.
Who were some of those people, if I can ask?
Well, our sous chefs at that time, the chef de cuisine was Alex Lee, who is one of the most amazing American cooks anywhere, and is still active in a country club in Long Island. Philippe Bertineau, who is now at Benoit and is the most underrated working chef in New York City. Lee Hansen and Riyad Nasser were sous chefs, and you know them from all of their success in
Balthazar,
Pastis, Schiller's, Mineta. And then the line cooks, you know, some of them are still here, like Jonathan Benno, and others have moved out of the city to create their own businesses, like Jim Fiala in St. Louis.
Wow, that's quite an all-star. That's like a dream team right there. Yeah. Huh?
Well, it's kind of like, what was it, the Côte Basque also had a similar kind of dream team. So many great chefs came out of that kitchen with Jean-Louis, whatever his name was,
At the Côte Basque. Yeah. Sorry, Rachou. Jean-Jacques
Rachou, yeah.
So what are some in that same vein? I mean, did Danielle teach you things to this day? I mean, or just those other chefs and that whole environment?
Yeah, well, the setting was new. So there were 80 seats in that dining room, and I had never worked in a restaurant that big, which is funny because on today's terms, that's not really very big.
How big were the two previous, the ones in France and the one in Japan?
The one in Japan had 24 seats, and the restaurant I worked in France all had this magic number of like 50 to 60 seats. And so, you know, in those restaurants, the difference between doing, you know, 50 covers and 58 covers was kind of like life and death. And so in this case, like I had never seen a restaurant that moved that fast. I had never seen colors used on a plate that were that loud and bold and exciting and bright. I had never seen mixing of ingredients and ideas on the plate. So what Danielle did at that time and continues to do is, in a very sensible way, has, you know, brought in a variety of ideas and ingredients on the plate, which speak to the tradition of French cooking and at the same time, you know, shatter all kinds of rules. And that's why it continues to be very exciting. I mean, technically speaking, they work at the highest level, but then behind the scenes, the restaurant and their cooking is always evolving. And so back then in my first glimpse of it, it was really cool. I mean, the dining room had modern art, the people at every level were very serious about what they were doing. And I was pretty psyched to be in New York City.
And what did you do at that restaurant? What part of the kitchen were you in?
I worked a couple stations. I worked at the Garmacher and I worked at the fish station. So in a 2 year period, I got to see, you know, about half of the kitchen.
And then Wayne Nish at March, was that...
So I met Wayne and decided to make the jump into becoming a sous chef at March Restaurant. And
so that's where that happened.
Yep. And that was... I worked there for several years and learned a whole new set of skills and lessons.
And when did you decide that... I mean, Gramercy Tavern from there, and we have a couple minutes here, and then we'll come back for a last segment, a potpourri of random questions that Katie and I have written down from talking. But, I mean, and then Gramercy Tavern, I mean, that must have been huge. I mean, that was your first kitchen that was truly yours at that scale. I mean...
The decision to come to that restaurant was not necessarily something that was planned out. It was a bit of an opportunity that came up a bit out of the blue. And while I was, you know, very familiar with Gramercy Tavern and always admired Danny's businesses, the decision to come on there, was really one of those moments that you don't plan for, and it happened, and I couldn't be more excited. I've been there for 5 years now, and it's like one of the best stages in the world to talk about food and to say something with an opinion about cooking, American cooking.
We're going to get into that. Katie, are you going to be able to do this third segment, having gone through all those successes, whereas you're just here on a Sunday co-hosting Heritage Radio Network?
I know.
Yeah, what have you made of your life?
That's exactly. exactly what I'm wondering. I'm going to have to go into the back room and just flagellate myself for a while during the break. But I'll be back.
We'll be back. She'll be back. Down from the mine to lay some money down. Stopped at a tavern they called Sweet Princess. There I met the girl in the red satin dress. Her gown shimmered scarlet as she walked across the room. I could see her soft skin and smell her sweet perfume. Her eyes flashed with lightning, she beckoned with her glance. My life might be in danger, I thought I'd take a chance. Hair black as a raven and eyes full of fire. Voice up there's a whisper, filled me with desire. Captured by her charm, like a man possessed. I fell for the girl in the red satin dress. Top of the stairs, I could smell her perfume, I knew she was there. But when I stepped inside, I faced another man. She came from behind, my knife was in her hand. I don't know what happened, my head was spinning round. I heard a soft voice whisper and stumbled to the ground. I saw a man lying, my knife deep in his chest. And gone was the girl in the red satin dress. Mercy, but can't find a trace. They don't believe my story. Time's run out, I guess. No one's seen a girl in a red satin dress. I'll stretch a rope and nobody cares. There's no one here to mourn when they lay me down to rest. All for the girl in the red satin dress. Hair black as a raven and eyes full of fire. Voice soft as a whisper, fill me with desire. Captured by her charm, like a man possessed. I fell for
back. This is the Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. Our show is sponsored today by the Hearst Ranch. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with Patrick Martins, and our guest in studio today is Mike Anthony from the fabulous Gramercy Tavern.
Sounds like we have an email question, or was it a call-in or an email?
It was an email to Heritage Radio. This is from Ted Kane, and he wants to know who Michael's favorite working chef in New York City right now is.
Ooh, tough one.
You gave a little hint cool. when you were talking about the alumni from Danielle.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really tough question to answer. Yeah. But you know what? I'm going to say something because this might not be a name that everybody recognizes yet, but they will very soon. and there's a personal connection, so I don't want to pretend that there isn't it. So a guy
that
I worked with at Gramercy Tavern, who has gone on to become the executive chef of Maialino, Nick Ander, is somebody that New York should pay attention to. And, you know, so Maialino, of course, is a restaurant in our company. And yeah, of course, there's got to, you know, there's support there. But better than that is, like, Nick is a smart guy who cares about his cooking, who has magic in his hands, and who doesn't want a guy like that working in their neighborhood. So, you know, we fortunately are not that far away from Maialino, and I love the approach to cooking that I know really well from having seen it firsthand working with Nick. But yeah, there are very few people that put that much care into the way things are made, and that's, you know, it doesn't matter what style they're cooking, but when there's that care of how things are made and how they taste and a sense of attention to how they taste, that's cool. So
now, does he, for instance, working at your kitchen and then going to his kitchen, will he keep the same purveyors that you did, or are you just like, listen, there's not enough of a supply? I mean, let's get in a little bit to the purveyors and how you guys share them within the restaurant, but also your own personal connections.
So in his case, you know, Nick has always been passionate about Italian cooking, and so there's a stylistic change there. Mm-hmm. He's applying himself to, you know, to really what is a heartfelt approach to cooking foods from Roman tradition. And the other beautiful thing is that our restaurants are they're operated independently. So it's the chef of each restaurant that makes the decision of where those ingredients come from and how they appear on the menu. And that is a wonderful thing, and it's a rare thing. You know, in today's you know, business age of restaurants multiplying at a, you know, an unbelievable pace, it can be a dangerous thing, you know, if an operator is not aware of, you know, how to leverage its size and leverage their different units. In our case, it's really something that it wouldn't exist unless it were supported from the top. And in that case, it makes each one of those restaurants unique. And that's where I want to eat. Those are restaurants that I want to experience when there's a decision from start to finish. And we know this, right? Good cooking comes from that initial decision of reaching out and making contact with a producer, talking about how those ingredients are made. They have to be anchored in a sense of time and place. Mm-hmm. And then every chef's got to make this decision of, hey, is this the taste? Is this the quality that I want to put on the plate? Does it work for me?
Now, how do you judge? Do you have higher food costs than most other restaurants? And is there a cap on what each of the restaurants are allowed?
Definitely not. I mean, we would, you know, that is, we are bound, you know, by a fiscal responsibility. And if our numbers didn't come up and didn't make our, you know, our partners satisfied, and didn't make, if they wouldn't make our P&L make sense, it wouldn't fly. And so there's no way to tell that story responsibly unless the numbers work. And we are responsible for those numbers. And it's a story that, you know, while the numbers might kind of be the boring part behind the scenes for a lot of passionate young cooks, it's an important story to tell. And, you know, when you're making a decision to buy a whole animal and incorporate it into your menu, if you haven't thought about how that animal is going to drive multiple menu items, and how you're going to train your staff to be able to, you know, really skillfully excel at using each one of the cuts out of that animal, if you don't have the basic room to hand, you know, to process that animal, then it's not a responsible decision. You might, you know, do it once in a while and get your, you know, get everybody fired up about the idea that you bought a whole pig or a whole lamb, or but if you really want to build your menu on that philosophy, then it has to be thought out, and the numbers at the end of the month have to make sense.
So well, how do you use whole animals at Gramercy and still make it work? Because I know you do bring that up. I saw a recent lovely edible magazine profile on you. How do you use the animals? I mean, is it just a staff that's announcing tons of specials, or is it charcuterie? Well, 'cause that's a lot of cut staff to weave into such a large place.
I mean, something needs to be said first, like that we have the opportunity to do that, meaning that the kitchen, it's a very beautiful kitchen. It's a very generous space. We have a bandsaw. We have a butcher's block. We have a walk-in that has been organized to accommodate hanging large cuts. And so from the beginning, we might, you know, have said, hey, we really want to do this. But if the kitchen didn't allow it, then it just never would have happened. The other thing is that the restaurant is built and it's a chef's dream, right? There's the tavern with 40 seats on the floor and another 18 at the bar that is a casual outlet. Not necessarily, I don't mean at all dumbed down food or a place where you can serve food that's left over. That is not the approach. It's there are dishes that are conceived that make sense in that space. Mm-hmm. You know, you walk in there, it has a no reservation policy. It's cool. It's a little louder than the main dining room. It's a great place for people to meet and have a drink and then kind of like start snacking on some things. And hopefully the food's good enough that it encourages them to want to order more. And so there's a... It was ahead of its time in terms of creating a cool tavern, pub, bistro, whatever you want to call it, but a venue for people to get together, hang out, and feel relaxed about food. And then from a chef's perspective, there's a wood-burning grill. There are four induction burners. There's an amazing refrigeration system and a station there that satisfies an a la carte menu. And we get to cook things like sausages, terrine stuffed meats, braises, grilled items. All, and that's not just meat. I mean, where vegetables come into play there. But the whole thing is that there's an outlet for, you know, if we're talking about that whole pig, some of it, a very little small portion of it will go to tasting menus in the main dining room. But what are you going to do with another, you know, the rest of that leg, the shoulders, collar, the, you know,
right.
And so there, you have to think about this ahead of time. So, you know, rather than going into the endeavor thinking, okay, you know, we want to get a specific breed and we want to tell this story about how good it is. And here, you know, here's the rack of pork. You have to think of it backwards. What are you going to do with everything first? And then the byproduct is actually that kind of nice noble
meats,
cut, the rack that goes. Right.
Is that a French tradition?
Yeah, I mean,
to use a whole cow in the restaurant?
Well,
or
is this
more an American
thing?
Funny
thing is, we've come around to say that, like, this, you know, this nose to tail eating is a newfound or kind of progressive idea. It is. I mean, it is in terms of American cooking, but it's also good cooking has always been, you know, built on thrift and on respectful usage of the resources that cooks have had. So there's nothing new about that. I mean, this is
well,
what has
yes.
made and defined good kitchens around the world forever.
But yeah. Do they bring in whole pigs in Japan, in France, in Italy? I mean,
well,
I'm sure some places do, but...
Interestingly, there's... you know, there's a newfound infatuation with exploring. And this is cool because, like, it makes sense in American cooking. Like, we're going back to explore what are the building blocks of good cooking. And I think if you ask cooks around the country these days what aspect of cooking they're most interested in, there's a small percentage that will still cite, you know, a number of really cool things about cooking. But I think most, and I don't know, throw a number out there, 65-70% of the cooks, my guess, would answer that butchery, charcuterie, and the kind of natural process of fermentation are these basic processes that they're most excited about. And
right.
And it makes good sense because, you know, this is a way for us to really connect with our region and
right,
producers.
Absolutely.
You were talking earlier about, you know, you have to think through and whether or not the bottom line matches up with the costs that you're incurring in the kitchen. So that brings up the whole thing that we wanted to talk about, which is that you can't, it's not enough to just be a great, you know, have a great palate and be a good cook. You really have to be a great manager and be
168 employees.
Yeah.
That,
I mean, you have 168 employees to manage, but you also have, you know, all those details. In other words, it's not just, you have to be able to crunch the numbers. You have to be able to cost out your stuff. You have to be able to figure out, you know, how your salary structure is going to work. All of those things are business.
You have to motivate people.
Are very business related, you know, concepts that don't have anything to do with whether or not you love to make a great, you know, gratin or tureen or something like
well,
that.
For me,
so how does
for me,
that
I,
work
I kinda
for
have
you?
The best of both worlds. I get paid to dream about food.
Yeah.
and I get to work with a staff that that loves what they do and it gives us the opportunity to take action on those ideas. But at the same time, one of the really amazing things about my job is that it's a learning experience. And, you know, so this idea of being responsible for a budget and a P&L and responsible for a staff, And to the level of attention that it's given in our company is it continues to be a real challenge, and it's also what makes it thrilling. Understanding, I love restaurants, and so understanding every aspect of it, and of course, cooking is what makes me most excited. But you know, understanding how a restaurant works and watching restaurants rise to success and some of them tank, it's a fascinating process. So
what do you
I love
think
the whole thing.
Is the primary reason that restaurants will tank?
No matter how great the chef is. Unfortunately, there are hundreds of reasons, and sometimes they don't add up. Sometimes it's not a summation of mistakes. Sometimes it's one of those things that
like
you can't explain.
Or something.
Not
yeah.
the right stuff at the right time in the right place. But there are also tons of ways that they can work almost inexplicably. So, it really is a matter of, kind of putting it out there, being serious about it, doing what you love, and telling your story. I mean, this is the other side of it is I think there's a fair amount of disdain for the way in which chefs have addressed the media. But you know what? Now more than ever, if you can or if you won't tell your story, and how are you going to let people know about what you're doing?
Well, that was one of the questions we had was like, how do you work with the media? How does the restaurant at your
yeah,
level
what news,
constantly
quote,
keep
unquote,
new
do you
things
have?
Coming
yeah.
in?
Well, we're lucky too. I mean, again, like working at Gramercy Tavern, we actually have an in-house PR marketing division, an office. And so the way in which that works is, there is an unlimited source of interesting stories that happen in our kitchen every day. And in the last 5 years we've even created new stations in our kitchen. We created a pasta station, we created a sous vide station, we created charcuterie station, we've created a pickling station. So mm-hmm. while these are things that as cooks we've been excited about over the years, and we might have used one or two of these techniques to incorporate into the menu, we never could look at it from the perspective of this is somebody's job. This is like, we have a fish station, we have a meat station, and now we have stations that really get to focus mm-hmm. on those techniques, and it creates all sorts of things that we incorporate into the menu, and I think that is
a way to keep the staff really spoken hot too. So, because if somebody comes up with some fantastic new piece of charcuterie or an extraordinary pickles, doesn't that help like the other guys think of like, oh, that would be great if we had this and this to put with it?
For sure, yeah. I mean, it creates a dynamic mm-hmm. environment. And then the thing you asked me about how do we connect with the media? Well, we can say, listen, what we're crazy about right now are these Nuka pot pickles. We're using rice bran to ferment pickles in a traditional Japanese way, but we're not presenting it as Japanese food and serving it in a traditional way. And I think that there's a fair amount of interest in learning about how pickles are made and this natural process of preserving the season. And so we can throw those ideas out there, and fortunately we have people in that department that are able to run with them. But the other thing is like literally just saying it to guests and putting it out there, that's where a lot of it happens. Listen, yeah. we spend a lot of time working with an elementary school in our neighborhood. And over the last 5 years, we've developed that program to a place where we're really proud of it. Actually is kind of one of the defining qualities of our restaurant. It's part of the DNA of the place. And it started with a parent walking by and saying, can my kid's first grade class come in and visit? And from there, we said, yeah. But we developed a dialogue, and we learned about what the teachers were doing and where they wanted to take this. We listened to the parents and what they wanted to do with their kids. And being a parent, like, look, just being a professional chef does not give me some sort of free pass. Like, it's a tough thing to do to, get your kids fired up about food. And so, by putting that story out there, we've been able to listen and learn along the way. So it's been cool.
And let me ask real quick, because we didn't ask this, and then we also were going to touch upon the organizations and stuff, but what is your management style? I understand listening, I've heard, is a theme, but how can you be tough, open, delegate, not micromanage, have you ever pigeonholed your philosophy?
I think that the way I think about it, and as I try to get better at what I do, it's being fair and accurate. If you let people know what the job is and what your expectations are, and you hold them accountable to that in a fair way. Sometimes it's tough. Sometimes it comes easy. You tell people what you're fired up about. You share a flavor. You show them a technique, and then everybody's on board. Other times, sometimes it's harder to get the idea across. And hey, we know that the kitchen is filled with, you know, with obstacles on a day-to-day basis. Our menu hinges on ideas that are simple, so that they can be memorable, and then tight execution. And when a restaurant of that size leaves, you know, mise en place raw on its stations to be cooked to order, if we make a mistake, you know, that synchronization is destroyed. Mm. And it's one of the things that I think goes unnoticed in a way, until it shows up in the freshness of the food. And you know, there are no neon signs on the front of Gramercy Tavern saying, you know, eat local. There's no blackboard in the restaurant stating the names of all of the producers that we use. But it, shouldn't people come to a good restaurant and expect that part of the deal is that you're going to taste food that is of not just excellent quality, but that's anchored to who we are and where we live.
Absolutely. Well, very, very interesting. Now let's talk a little bit about, you were talking about these children that came in from the first grade. What is the, you know, kind of 501c3 support mandate of Gramercy Tavern? And I know you're involved with some things in Japan and you have a big event in September. So talk a little bit about your community outreach.
Part of every one of Danny's restaurants is based on community involvement. And from day one, it's been a very clear message that he's put out there. And in our case, we've had the ability to run with it in a couple of areas. And, you know, we were talking about the kids, partly based on, you know, thinking about food from a dad's perspective and how I, you know, want to introduce food to my kid. Thinking about it, you asked me as a kid, I was a terrible eater. And, you know, not putting any blame on my parents or grandparents. We had great food traditions. But, you know, it just kids grow up in, and not just kids. We've all grown up in a country that has a very distant relationship with the food that we eat. So we got to address that. And we also found a school that, you know, that was actively engaged in asking this question of what role a restaurant plays in their community. This is, you know, part of the standard curriculum of introducing young kids to the world around them. But yet we got a chance to take that idea a step further and use food as a vehicle to make that exploration. And now as this evolves, we're able to even touch on these ideas of not just like, it's not about the propaganda of leading kids to the green market, although that's a great discovery for them. It's a window of opportunity. And as they grow up now, they know that there's a place to, you know, go back and make these discoveries. But the real idea is to introduce them to look at the world around them a little differently, to recognize beauty and recognize weirdness and recognize things that are cool and make you laugh and draw your attention. So, you know, we're working on an artistic component that goes into this idea just to get kids to look at food closer. And ironically, I think it's one of the biggest challenges that we have in the kitchen. And we have, in terms of developing as a cook, you know, you learn the techniques, you learn the ability to do it faster and smoother and cleaner. You also learn the ability to take care of and be aware of the way people feel around you while you're doing it. But yet this notion of it's very difficult to teach or share with folks how to recognize things that are beautiful around you in terms of food and how to take the same ingredients that everybody works with and look at them differently. And, you know, we see this. I see this, like, these are revelations. I see this in the hands of some of our cooks on an average day doing a dish that we've done for a while, taking these ingredients and looking at them differently, slicing them differently, suggesting that we cook them differently. And all of a sudden, you know, that beet is not just the same old beet that, you know, we've come up with cool ways to serve it. Yet all of a sudden it's a brand new thing. And I think translating that, it's a little complicated. I'm not sure if I'm really getting my point across, but it's like this is the ultimate goal of working with those kids is just to introduce them to the physical world around them and showing them that, you know what, food is, it can be a lot of fun. It can be really cool and it can be really weird, but it, you know, there should be this connection, right? You should be able to hold it in your hands and take note of that stuff.
Well, tell us about, are you doing, you mentioned something as we were having our traditional shot of Fernet before the radio show, about some support you're doing in Japan. Is there Well, it must be important to you having lived there. And
so, you know, I mean, I'm sure that everyone like us is glued to the news. And it's this very kind of horrific feeling of disbelief that so many things could have impacted that country all at once. It's also this notion of, you know what, I feel connected, but I want to help, and I'm not sure how to, and it's a very, you know, it's a long way away, and it's confusing. But fortunately, you know, Danny and the company has a restaurant in Tokyo, and the executive chef, Michael Romano, who is a senior managing partner of our company and our culinary director, has organized a dinner to take place at Gramercy Tavern that is organized through the Japan Society, and the proceeds from that dinner will go directly to the relief fund. Mm. And we're experimenting, or, you know, kind of thinking of ways in which we might be able to raise more money through that dinner to do something quickly and meaningfully. But, you know, just to put it out there, you know, I think just the, if individuals want to help or organizations want to help, there are some very easy steps to take. And, you know, through this process of getting organized, we've recognized that the Japan Society is a huge organization, a cultural organization, but with its leadership from Mr. Sakurai, have been able to connect in a very interesting way with organizations in Japan. So so we've targeted the Japan Society as a funnel for a lot of that effort, energy, and money. The Japanese Red Cross is also a way to go kind of directly to Japan, but even through the International Red Cross, you can designate where your dollars, you know, where you'd like to see them spent. So from our angle, I think we feel a sense of grief, and a strong sense of desire to do something fast to help in whatever way we can. So in that sense, I've been impressed with how much I've heard from restaurants and people around the city who feel connected. It'd be easy to disconnect from that, but I don't see that.
Well,
I see
we need
people
to feel
something concerned. Has to happen fast, but it also has to be remembered years from now. Sometimes people think they do something right away, but then, like in Haiti, talks about it anymore.
Yeah, but
so
they still need
short-term, long-term.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, what about in September? Is there a big charity event that you have planned?
So there's this really rich relationship formed over the years between an organization called Share Our Strength and the Union Square Hospitality Group.
Is Sandra Lee really the face of Share Our Strength?
That I don't know.
That
but,
upsets
you know,
me.
I have to say
Sandra
that
Lee from Greece?
The Food Network.
Oh. You know, they do have a dynamic leader in Billy Shore, who's an amazing public speaker. But in our case, what that means to Gramercy Tavern is that we're celebrating the 18th year of hosting an event called the Autumn Harvest Dinner, in which amazing, amazing talent has been invited as guests to the restaurant over the years to cook and to share. And last year, that event came back to Gramercy Tavern, so it was my first time to participate. Mm-hmm. We asked Grant Achatz, Dave Chang, and Sean Brock to come and hang out in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And not only did they cook really interesting, amazing dishes, but they were generous with their time. Our staff couldn't have been more psyched to get to hang out with those guys. And it was great. So, you know, for me, the underlying connection there behind the scenes was talking about American cooking, right? These guys all have their own take on food, and our styles are very different, one from the other. But yet it was a great group. Mm-hmm. So this year, again, on September 26th, we'll be inviting, guest chefs, bakers and, pastry chefs to join us, along with Danny, Billy Shore and Share Our Strength to create what is one of their important fundraisers of the year. So
very nice. And you can go to GramercyTavern.com for more information.
And, you know, their goal is to fight and end childhood hunger, so it couldn't be for a better cause.
Absolutely fantastic. Well, what an honor. Thank you so much for spending so much time with us and really giving our archive a lens into Gramercy, into you, into the
into
hospitality
American
group.
Cooking,
yeah,
which we really didn't get to the bottom
of.
Number one
Zagat-rated restaurant for all these years. I mean, that is nothing, cannot be denied. So anyway, thank you so much, and hope to have you back.
Thanks a lot. Had a great time.
And we'll be back in just a minute to talk about maple sugar.
Right back.
Lord made the working girls, he made the blues. Well, I'm tired of working my life away and giving somebody else all of my pay. Hey, while they get rich on the profits that I lose and leave me here with those working girl blues. Idea lady, working girl blues. And I can't even afford a new pair of shoes while they can live in any old penthouse they choose. And all that I've got is a working girl blues. But I wonder, will my hair be all turned gray?
This is the main chorus on Heritage Radio Network, and our last segment for this Sunday at Roberta's, 261 Moore Street in Bushwick. Our program has been sponsored today by the Hearst Ranch and engineered and produced by the wonderful Jack Inslee. Thank you, Jack. I'm
Jack,
your host, Katie Kiefer, with
thanks,
Patrick
guys.
Martins. Patrick, you just got back from Vermont.
But I want to talk about Temple Grandin. We have Temple Grandin on next week.
We do.
That is an
honor. We're going to actually record a little.
She loves you. Where? How did you become such good friends with her?
Well, because
you were taking a tour, right?
I was sent on a tour of the Cargill meatpacking plant through my buddies at Certified Angus Beef and mm-hmm. Food Arts magazine. And Certified Angus Beef, really, they jumped through hoops to make this happen for me. I'm endlessly grateful to them for it. And then the Cargill folks really just rolled over and let me in and brought Temple in to show me her part of the plant, which is the animal handling facility, obviously.
Yeah.
And she and I really hit it off. She's an extremely gregarious woman.
You were hanging out in the hotel room with her.
She came back
everything.
To after my tour. She was very distressed at the idea. Well, I wouldn't say very distressed, but she didn't like the idea that I was going to be spending the rest of the afternoon and the evening by myself in this crappy little motel off the highway outside of Fort Morgan, Colorado. I was okay with it because I had plenty of notes to write down and stuff. But anyway, she came back to the hotel room. And we hung out and chit-chatted, and she did her business, and I did my business, and then we went and had dinner together. And, you know, if you want to talk about the cattle industry, animals, livestock handling, you know, there is just no end of conversation.
So what are some of the questions you're going to ask her? I mean, like, what tack
well, are
you
I have
going
a lot
take?
Of. I there's a lot of things I want to ask her about. First of all, I want to ask her about the hog and poultry industries because she has not been as active in those fronts as she has been in the cattle industry. And I know that more and more people are concerned about those aspects of the protein market. I want to talk to her about ethanol subsidies, which actually legislation has just been introduced to end ethanol subsidy.
She gets involved in that type of thing?
She does, because they feed the animals distillers, you know, dried distillers grains. And grains and solubles, they call them DDGS. And those are not necessarily all that great for the cattle. And they are certainly not available as fodder for hogs and poultry, who are the big corn users. And so, you know, all that stuff and the impact of those costs on farmers, mm-hmm. The whole meatpacking industry and where it's going and how public scrutiny has influenced what we're seeing now in terms of her own career and how she's taken off. You know, in the last 5 years, but like even before that, she
had a whole movie with Claire Danes.
She has designed a lot of livestock handling facilities around the world, not
did
just
she
in the
make
United
an
States.
Appearance in that movie, like in the background, like Alfred Hitchcock, who's like in the background?
I don't think she did
that.
Actually, but we can ask her that. What she did do was have a tremendous influence on the script, and she was there for all of the shooting. And so, being an outspoken person who, you know, doesn't sugarcoat anything. If something was happening that she didn't agree with, she would absolutely make sure that it was 100% the way it really happened. So, so that, yeah, it's going to be tremendous to have her on. She's a wonderfully informed, and really very entertaining conversationalist. I really liked her a lot.
She won't like me. I'm not going to talk.
Don't interrupt her because she doesn't like that.
Really? Especially yeah. over the phone.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Then the other thing we should, so that's going to happen next weekend. And by the way, Whole Foods is going to join us for a few minutes towards the end of that segment because Temple helped them come up with guidelines about the kinds of producers that they're using, to select their protein producers. And I thought that was a really interesting sort of synergy there, where you see a major grocery chain that is making major demands on their production, on their producers, in terms of animal husbandry, certified humane, you know, where the animals are taken care, are harvested, my favorite word in the lexicon there. The harvesting and the processing of those animals is all, you know, Whole Foods is taking a very proactive stance about how that happens. And I think other grocery chains will be following suit. But I think it's great that they're leading the way. And of course, they are a sponsor for Heritage Radio Network. And that's another reason why we're proud to be sponsored by them.
And when we get our 501c3 status officially, we hope we'll get a 5% day. I've already approached Ellie.
Yeah.
Talking about that with her on Wednesday.
It's really a great organization in many ways. So
as I was driving back from Vermont, actually.
Yeah, tell us about quickly about Vermont trip.
Four Whole Food trucks or three massive 18-wheelers. Funny, I guess they...
distribution happens Kingdom. It happens at night.
Well, the maple syrup thing I was fascinated with. I spent 5 days with Howie and Stefan Cantor.
And Stefan was on this show last week. Yeah.
Yep.
So
they're in West Glover, Vermont. And Glover
which is way up in the northwest corner of the state.
Refer to it as the Northeast Kingdom.
Oh, the Northeast Kingdom.
It's very sparsely populated. Everybody knows everybody. They have a couple of real awesome, there's some real historic places there, like Jasper Hill Caves have started there recently. Of course, there's Deep Mountain Maple. There's a Couriers, which has more, it's a big kind of market there. They have more taxidermy than I've ever seen anywhere.
Oh my God, you must
sell
have
everything.
Absolutely thrilled to your marrow.
I loved it.
Did you buy anything?
No, they didn't sell taxidermy. I would have spent like my entire savings if they did. But
you know, Michael is still in the studio. Michael, I want you to know that I purchased for Patrick an incredibly fabulous piece of taxidermy. Three mangy, horrible little squirrels who were probably stuffed around 1900 and look at moth-eaten little rodents on a lovely woodland scene.
Cool. Now I know what to get you next year.
And strangely enough, Patrick has not completely resonated with this offering, and it has not gone into the home area.
It's in my line of
sight. It hasn't gone to
the
home area. I think Ann doesn't like it.
So then I was amazed. Parker Pie is an unbelievable restaurant up there. It's actually owned by the son of the Cantors.
Yeah.
And it's a real kind of mini Roberta's of the Northeast Kingdom. The Bread and Puppet Theater. Howie was huge into
the
Bread and Puppet Theater.
Who remembers the Bread and Puppet Theater? That was a huge big deal when I was growing up.
It's real political puppetry.
I remember coming to New York as a small child.
So they have a barn which is open to the public. It's open all the time. You just have to turn the lights on, and the only request is that you turn the lights off when you leave. And it is a, you know, football field size barn filled with these immense puppets.
They're huge. They're life size or larger puppets.
No, yeah, they're like, you know, 50 feet. I mean, they're huge puppets. Yeah, not all of them. But real, real unbelievable. And Howie was the head puppeteer for Bread and Puppet
That's fantastic.
20 years. And for the past 30 years, they've been, you know, the green market.
They've been sugaring.
Well, they've been the Union Square Green Market maple syrup representative. And, you know, you can watch more on the Heritage Radio, Heritage Foods USA website. But, I mean, I was so... touched.
So the Golden Boys created our auxiliary Golden Boy, Billy Saxelby, and Andrea, our main Golden Boy, created a video of the sugaring experience of Patrick and Dan toting those bales.
And we sold about 200 liters of their syrup to through our mail order campaign for $45. There's still a few left. $45, you get a liter of their maple syrup delivered. And, you know, I was real struck by the woods. You know, I mean, first of all, these only in this part of the world, you know, do these trees produce syrup. only at a specific time when it freezes at night and it's above freezing during the day. Mm-hmm. That is the time that maple syrup runs. So it's this critical moment, you know, where they have all these little taps. It used to happen with buckets where you would just put a bucket under a tap on a tree and hang it from the tree. Now they have this these tubes that connect all the trees in their forest, and they have this machine that sucks the sap to these pans, which then are brought to the sugar house. So you go to their lovely little house in the woods, and then you walk about 15 minutes down the hill deep into the forest, and there's this pulsating, you know, smokestack building that's the sugar house. And there's about three or four people there throwing three different types of woods into the fire.
And why three different types of wood?
Because they say that's burn the best different fire.
They it burn has to at be different very temperatures.
Very precise mm-hmm. the temperature, or else the pan risks burning. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to keep it very. So, I mean, he talk about vigilant. I mean, yeah. Howie is working basically three straight weeks. 15 hours.
Yeah, I was going to say 18
hours. When the sap runs, he's there to do it. It's also their whole annual income is all through a 3 week period. So, you know, it's all made at that time. Yeah. So I just had tremendous amount of respect for the amount of work, dedication it takes, and also the woods. I mean, this woods are producing the syrup, but also the woods are supplying the fuel for the fire. And they go through cords and cords of wood.
Well, you and Dan moved, what did you tell me? Ten cords of wood?
And that's a cord a huge is amount of four wood. By 4 by 8.
Yeah.
And, you know, they would cut it. And, you know, I love also the way the community rallies around the sugaring process and comes all the way down to the sugar house and will bring Howie, you know, a shot of rum. He also cooks food in a lodge pot. You know, which is located
lodge
under
is those
the fire.
Big, those big cast iron cookware.
Yeah. And anyway, it's just very, very warm. And, you know, I think, you know, people don't know the true process of maple syrup. And it was real touching to be with them. And
well, people can listen to our interview last week. Excuse me.
You need some maple syrup?
Yeah, I need some maple syrup.
And by the way, everything is better in maple syrup. They were serving me hot dogs and pork chops all in this master
sauce. I have the cocktail. This is the cocktail. This, by the way, maple syrup is supposed to be a cleanse. So I read this on the internet. I know we have to go in a minute, but lemon juice, maple syrup, cayenne pepper, and then presumably you put some water in it. Okay, well, I put vodka in it and seltzer.
Oh, my
and
God.
It is unbelievably good.
Is that why you're under good. 250 now?
That's
for the
exactly
first time?
Right.
That
this is the maple good. Syrup diet. Stop drinking wine and start drinking maple syrup, lemon juice, and cayenne. I'm telling you. And I've been using those little piquillo peppers that Ben Flanner gave me from the Brooklyn Grange last year. I had them all dried out in my kitchen, and they are awesome. They're wicked hot.
Well, we are very excited. Next week is also the Museum of Food and Drink fundraiser, and we're really honored to be helping support that cause.
At Del Posto.
Yeah, and we'll have Temple Grandin.
And we have a big piece. We have a piece coming out about it in Time Out New York.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, so that actually should be online right now if you want to read more details. And please tune in for Temple Grandin either during the time or just after as we archive all of our programs.
And the next big trip for Heritage Foods is down to North Carolina to help with the triggerfish harvest.
That's right.
I don't know, is it called a harvest?
Our first fresh catch fish buy.
Yeah, exactly. First of the few social buys. So anyway, thanks so much for listening, and we will be back in 7 days with Temple Grandin on the phone.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jack. Thanks, Hurst. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. The Snacky Tunes compilation has arrived and is available for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com. This compilation features live performances from some of the hottest acts around today, including Midnight Magic, Surfer Blood, Oberhofer, and more. Again, you can download this compilation for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com, and make sure to listen to Snacky Tunes every Monday at 2 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? To kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Omofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Bolte of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of BR Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.